House Judiciary is called to order. It's 2:10. It is the 22nd of March, and we do have a quorum present for the record as the whole committee. Representative Gruenberg, Cott, Anderson, Coghill, Guerra, Wilson, and myself, McGuire. We have two items on the agenda today. I'm going to reverse the order to accommodate a schedule change. So first, we'll bring up House Bill 414, Interception of Minor Communications. This is the second bill hearing. The bill is by Representative Cott, and so we'll hear about that. And then Senate Bill 20, Offenses Against Unborn Children, we'll bring up next. And I think this is the third bill hearing on that. So without further ado, you're going to tell us about, you've already told us about 414. You're just going to tell us where we are in the process.
That's correct, Madam Chairman. For the record, Mike O'Hare, staff for Representative Pete Cott. Thank you for time and scheduling this before the Judiciary Committee. We've had the privilege to work with Representative Gruenberg with regards to some concerns he's had regarding interception of minors' communications and how they would might impact the family law issues of divorce and child custody issues. And I want to personally thank Representative Gruenberg for his time. I know it's been precious for him lately, being ill, and but we certainly appreciate his time. We've also want to say that the sponsor and staff hold Representative Gruenberg in the highest regard. And what we've done.
It's like a condolence speech. But is there a but coming?
Okay. Not at all. Never. Representative Gruenberg has requested that we solicit opinions from the family law group of the Alaska Bar Association to see what their interpretation of what might happen should this bill become law with regards to custody and divorce cases. It was an issue. In the supplemental package you received are those responses via email to Representative Gruenberg and myself. Some of these responses predict catastrophic, unbridled eavesdropping, just to quote, recording interference with family law. Some predict violations of privacy. And as stated before, the sponsor understands the issues of privacy. And what we try to do is establish a balance between the respect for privacy and the protection of our children. These responses have come back from attorneys that have a lot of experience in the family law practice. These are also speculations as to what might happen. They are speculations. And in light of these responses, the sponsor requested a follow-up report from Legislative Research, which is also in your packet. The request was to find out if there's any abuse of the law in Georgia, in the state of Georgia. I think it's the only state that has actually the law enacted, and to see if there has been abuse with regards to vicarious consent and interception of minors' communications. The report's in the packet. Basically, the report states that since the law was enacted in 2000, there has been no evidence of catastrophic abuse of the system as far as Georgia courts being inundated with vicarious consent recordings and family law issues. And again, since these are speculations and we're going to speculate, I'd like to speculate that if this law is enacted, possibly if we allow parents to protect the kids from predators and we allow parents to record these communications, then perhaps in a family law issue, maybe, just maybe, that the parents will be civil to one another, knowing that possibly that the recordings are, the conversations are being recorded. Either way, there's no evidence of abuse in 6 years in Georgia, state of Georgia, that has been acted. Basically, what we're looking for is the tools to monitor our kids without having to break the law or having parents spend time and money arguing the legality of intercepting these communications in a court while our children would continue to be abused. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We do have a CS then. Someone want to make a motion?
That's the Y version, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. F version, Madam Chairman. Also, there's amendment on top of that as well.
Another version? We're not on the Y version anymore?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, a same version, F, Foxtrot.
Okay, while members are gathering that, Shalon can get you one if you don't have it, the F version.
And Madam Chair, then, is that the one that's already before us?
No.
They're not offering the CS. They're offering the printed version.
Refetties. Record, there was a bit of confusion. We do have the F version before us properly. It's already been adopted, and then there's an amendment forthcoming. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. O'Hare, I can't tell what Mr. Burnham did, but you told me, did you not, that what he had done was looked at a copy of the annotated code. That was the extent of his research, right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that was the original report, the original Ledge Research report. As my understanding, Mr. Burnham had gone through several databases, including Westlaw, and inquired with the state of Georgia. I'm not sure to what extent or the details, and so he got us the supplemental report, sir.
Now, where's the supplemental report?
It's in the packet, the smaller one, sir.
I seem to only have one dated March 21. Is there something else I don't have?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the original report was in your original packet, legislative research report. It's pretty hefty. Mm-hmm. Be glad there.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay.
February 6, 2006.
Okay. But the only thing that he has done, it looks like, on the March 21 report was to attach a copy of the Georgia law annotated. What he says was, and in the second paragraph, we found no evidence, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't state what steps he took, what research he took. And the reason I'm concerned about that, Madam Chair, is because the only kind of evidence that would appear in looking at this annotated statutes would be reported cases that the publisher put in the annotation. It doesn't even include the stuff, all the stuff that's in West. And as those of us who work with these daily know, that the annotations are far more limited than are in the digests. And the digests themselves only contain those cases in which that specific issue was taken up to the appellate court and those cases that the appellate court issued a publishable opinion. Most of the, at least a lot of the opinions in most of these courts now, including Alaska, are MOs and Js, memorandum orders and judgment. They're never published. They do not find their way into the reported decisions at all. And what I am saying and what these other lawyers are saying are what happens in the actual trials that would never show up unless you really made an extreme investigation of the entire Georgia bar and the Superior Court benches. Bob Russell, a former lawyer from Alaska, is now in the Superior Court, for example, there. And it really, unless he's done that, he does not have the kind of evidence that these lawyers who have dozens of years' experience have. And I am, and we are all unanimous in finding problems with this. And I'm going to move to strike section, the final section of the bill on the conforming thing, because this is going to find its way into divorce courts all over the place in this state.
Okay, well, when we last left the bill, I thought by setting it aside.
Oh, we have some testimony too. People on the line.
I thought that by setting it aside for a period of time that a consensus might be reached. Sometimes it is. In this case, it was not. And so what we'll do is I'm going to go ahead and take the public testimony that is out there to be offered, and then we'll take up the debate in the form of amendments then.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have on teleconference David Baranow. Mr. Baranow, are you there?
Yes, I am. I am here. Thank you.
Okay, we're ready to take your testimony on House Bill 414.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. By way of brief introduction, I'm an attorney here in Anchorage, a lifelong Alaskan and the father of two children. I sent one email to Mr. O'Hara as well on this issue. My area of concentration in practice is family law. I have not heard all of the discussion. I did come in as one of the bill sponsors was talking about it. I can assure you and all present that we are not speculating when we're talking about the inadvertent or intentional eavesdropping that already takes place in these cases. Hundreds, if not thousands, of times over my 26-year career, we are faced with Superior Court judge admonishing, ordering, holding people in contempt for intentionally interfering with telephonic communication between children and divorced parents. I think that the intent of this bill to provide a tool to avoid predation on our children is laudable, and I applaud it. From my perspective, and looking at it from a family law practitioner's perspective, it is rife with a great deal of problems and concerns. The language of the bill itself, the version that I was able to review, is couched in very broad terms: good faith, best interests of the child, good faith belief. In practice, what that means is that we're going to have parents that are going to be restricting communications. It is not speculation. I deal with this all the time. And if I'm concerned that in another context, intercepting, monitoring this kind of communication between other third parties would be a Class C felony in our state. Why is it not the same for parents and children? Take it into its worst extreme. What about the child that is abused or is being abused in the household, and the only place that they can turn is to the non-custodial parent? If they know that their conversations are going to be taped, monitored, interfered with, it's a huge chilling effect on the ability of that child to be able to relate the problems that are going on in the home. And certainly there are other places they can go, teachers, medical care providers, and the like, but it is a mistake, in my opinion, to chill that communications avenue for the child and the non-custodial parent. There is abuse. It's rampant. And I certainly would join in my colleague, Mr. Gruenberg's opinions here. I don't know where the research was from. If you just look at the annotations, that's not going to tell you what happens down here in the trenches. And that's why I wanted to take the time out of my day, and I appreciate you taking the time out of yours to listen to me, that if this bill needs to go forward, I mean, I suggest strongly that you look into the issue of custodial parent interference with communications and either fashion some protection in that regard or take another look at the practical impact of this bill. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay, I only have one other person signed up, Alan Bailey. Hi, Alan. There?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm here. This is Alan Bailey, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I've called to testify on House Bill 414. As I told Representative Gruenberg and a staffer for Representative Cott by email, I think there are two problems with this bill, and I'm not sure if either of them can be easily solved. The first problem I see as a lawyer who's not a family lawyer is that if we have a court issuing what amounts to a private search warrant to intercept the communications of another person, the court is granting a search warrant without probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And I believe that would be, again, a violation of the federal constitution as well as the Alaska state constitution's even higher privacy guarantees. Perhaps more close to home for me as a family lawyer, I've been a lawyer in Alaska for 32 years, and the majority of my clients are victims of domestic abuse. and there are many children in these families that are also abused. I'm concerned that an abusive parent would, in essence, remove the ability of a child to report domestic violence or sexual abuse that is occurring in the home, whether there's been a divorce or not. There are many victims of domestic violence who have not yet left their partners. Some of them are too frightened to do so because the research shows that the likelihood of domestic violence and severe domestic violence increases dramatically at about the time of separation. So these may be in so-called intact families where one of the parents is abusing the other and possibly one of the children. This would permit such a parent to maintain absolute control over all communications leaving the home and in essence enable that parent to prohibit the child from calling for help. I think it's a bill that was drafted for a good reason because of problems that have occurred across the country with minors being victimized by people they meet through electronic communications. But I don't think this is how that problem is solved. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Alan. I respect your opinion a whole lot. We were just sitting here talking before. You know, I hope you can see that at least part of the motivations for the bill are in the best interest of a child. If you had a situation where, I don't know, your child came in touch with the wrong crowd, perhaps adult drug dealers, you know, in that age of 20, 21, something like that, where you want to get a feel for what's going on and you've tried every other avenue with your child, I can assure you that I would listen in, and I didn't know it was illegal before, and I bet you there are a ton of criminal parents running around this building as well that all had the best interests of their child at hand. So if you take that as a given, what is a way that you've thought of to get at the problem that you see? And we were just kind of looking, I was looking at the exempt activities, for example, under the bill, and maybe a way to get at it would be to say that, you know, interception of private communication between parents that are involved in a custody dispute or a divorce might be a way to do it. But I wondered if you'd thought about it instead of just throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Madam Chair, I certainly share your concern about children who are drawn into inappropriate relationships and contacts through the internet and telephone communications, and that is a genuine problem, and I haven't been able to come up with a way of dealing with that in a way that would be easy to incorporate into a bill. I've been in trial most of the day, so I'm sort of not in a normal communication mode.
That's okay. I just wondered if you had. I know Representative Gruenberg also practices in the area of family law, as you know, so we'll see what his idea is. But I think that's, you know, what some of the committee members are struggling with, is that there's a part of it that's appealing, and yet I can see the problem that you've presented. So, Representative Gruenberg.
Alan, this is Max Gruenberg. Our courts, and I'd expand my question to include David Barrenau. David, are you still on the line? And Mike Kramer. Mike,
yes,
are you?
Yes, Mr. Gruenberg, I am here.
Who's that?
This is David Barrenau.
Okay, and Mr. Kramer, are you there too? In Fairbanks?
Got a note that said he joined.
Well, I'll ask who's ever there. Given our court's expansive use an interpretation of the right of privacy. Do you see any constitutional problems with that section of the bill? And I'm referring to the section on page 3, which is actually section 3, but the guts of it are on page 3 and the top of page 4, allowing a parent to intercept phone calls that are allegedly private between somebody and a child without any kind of a warrant or anything like that. Do you see any either Fourth Amendment problems or equivalent under Alaska Constitution or right of privacy problems constitutionally? Any one of you people?
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenberg, this is Alan Bailey. I have a fear that if we allow a court to grant private search warrants on less than probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, we are in perilous constitutional waters. Under the federal constitution and Alaska's constitution has been construed to be even more restrictive as to privacy issues. If the bill were drafted to permit the issuance of some sort of court order upon a higher degree of showing that there is reasonable cause to believe that someone is attempting to commit a crime against the child, that would certainly eliminate that as an objection to this bill.
And as I, Madam Chair, as I read the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4, it allows an interception without any search warrant at all. That concerns me even more. I'm sort of soliloquizing. Thank you. Go ahead, Madam Chair.
Okay, I think that's a good lead. I'm going to close testimony unless Mike Kramer is on the line after all.
I am Representative McGuire. And Representative Gruenberg, I didn't understand how to work the mute button here at Fairbanks, but I have been online and have been listening.
Okay, did you want to offer testimony on House Bill 414?
I did.
Okay, go ahead and tell us.
Well, I'd like to speak against this bill for a number of reasons. Primarily, I'm a family law attorney here in Fairbanks, and I think that a bill that would authorize parents to randomly intercept and record their children's communications with anybody would probably result in communications with the other parent, particularly in a divorce situation or when the parents are estranged, that this bill would mostly be utilized by parents as free rein to record surreptitiously contacts between their child and the other parent, and could be used in court, obviously, because there would be no prohibition. I mean, currently, we all know this goes on, and I think people that practice in the area have all been delivered tapes of various phone calls recorded by their clients or recorded by, the other party that they come into possession of, and courts have sometimes listened to those. Often they refuse to hear them, but custody investigators and other interested people, children's counselors and things, are routinely provided copies of surreptitiously recorded recordings, and I think only through the specter of, well, that's currently illegal, unless one of the parties consented to the recording, these things are still used, but they'd be used on a much wider scale and abused is my concern, and that a parent and an earlier speaker brought up in the case of an abuse situation where the child himself is being abused or if there's another victim of domestic violence within that family unit that's going through a divorce proceeding, that to allow one party to record and manipulate the situation upon which the conversation was recorded, could lead to some obvious problems in regards to a custody dispute, and that and also involve the kids directly into the parents' dispute, which is often a goal of judges to try to keep the kids as far removed as possible. I think that the bill has that the stated intent is to help protect children, to give parents a tool to protect children from internet predators and that type of thing. And while that's certainly a admirable goal, particularly in light of recent news events and the obvious problems with keeping children away from access to people that, that would cause them harm in a variety of ways. I think the bill goes too far, and it would cause many problems between parents and between families that were unintended, while not really solving the problem that the bill seeks to solve. I have also concerns from a civil libertarian perspective as to the intrusion that we're authorizing here on behalf or at the expense of anyone under the age of 18, where their parents or guardian can just randomly, set bugs and recordings and record their conversations with whoever, whether it be the other parent, whether it be peers and or whether it be counselors. I know there's exceptions in here for, well, you can't record it between their guardian ad litem or their attorney, but that's a rare situation where a child's going to be talking to their guardian ad litem or their attorney over the phone. And I don't think that exception's really going to matter much once the authorization to record is there, that the parent could simply argue, well, I picked up that recording by accident. I think that children do have some reasonable expectation of privacy, that their phone calls will not be monitored, and particularly that their parents will not authorize law enforcement, which is the second part of this bill, that their parent or guardian can't go out and authorize police officers to put a tap on their phone, their cell phones, their internet emails, things like this, and essentially authorize the monitoring for law enforcement purposes of their own children. I certainly think that would be used, and it would lead to a breakdown in trust between parents and children. It would lead children to believe that until they're an adult that, the government freely would allow people to record them and monitor the conversations. But I won't take up too much more of the committee's time. I just wanted to speak against this bill. I think it has a noble purpose, but I think it goes too far and it erodes the constitutional rights of everyone involved, and I think it would be misused and abused in the legal system, particularly in the case of divorces and domestic violence proceedings.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else here in the audience that I've overlooked? Anybody, would you like to testify? Senator Dyson.
Madam Chair, can I just make a comment to...
Sure, go ahead and have a seat.
Mike Kramer.
Yes.
Mike, this is Representative Wes Guerra speaking. This bill is going to keep moving through the process. I understand some of your concerns, and I shared them originally, but in the end, I think in family relationships, I think when government tries to draw the line between what conversations you can have and not have and what conduct you can allow and not allow, I think it gets very messy. And if you can come up with a way to deal with this bill but protect against the problems of sort of vindictive parents who are going through a divorce, that would be helpful. But short of that, I think the concern of a parent to protect the child is greater than the also important interest of the child to have independence. It's a hard one, but I'm leaning towards the sponsor's view on this one. I would love to see an amendment that would be able to protect against the problem of the sort of vindictive parents going through a divorce. But you talked about sort of promoting healthy family relationships, and if you're already at this point where parents are doing stuff like this and willing to be vindictive, by telling us you can't be vindictive by recording a phone call isn't going to make that parent a good parent. That parent has already sort of crossed the line between protecting a child and not protecting a child's best interest. So the phone call I don't think is going to be the biggest problem the child has at that point. An amendment at some point during the process might be useful. I, for the life of me, can't think of one on this one. So I just wanted to ask for your help if you can think of anything along the way.
Representative Grunberg.
Madam Chair, kind of to respond in the same vein to Representative Guerra, the court has said that children have a right, a constitutional right, to certain medical procedures even without even notifying their parents, and that they have a right of privacy in their own bodies. And it deals with the health. It's really a health issue for these children. If a child whose parents are warring or potentially warring is caught in the middle because their telephone conversations are intercepted. That could have a very real effect on that child's health and mental well-being. And it seems to me, from a constitutional point of view, and I'm kind of responding in a very basic constitutional sense to you, Representative Guerra, because I know of your concern about the Constitution, that the constitutional right of privacy would be the same. Courts would come out the same way. Anybody want to comment on that online?
This is Alan Bailey. Madam Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I mentioned earlier my belief that a court, in effect, issuing a private search warrant to intercept communication between a child and anyone, on less than probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed or is being attempted, is going to run afoul of the privacy guarantees of both the U.S. and the Alaska Constitution, in my opinion. And these are not rights that are to be taken lightly. In fact, they have been used by our courts from time to time to keep criminals that we know are guilty from being prosecuted for crimes because the evidence was obtained in violation of their rights to privacy. These are important rights. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chairman, this is Attorney David Barrino. I'm still online, and I would echo the sentiments of both Representative Gruenberg and my colleague, Mr. Bailey. I too, in my considered opinion, believe that we would be abridging privacy rights guaranteed by not only the federal constitution, but by the state of Alaska's constitution as well. I hearken back to one of the comments made by the sponsoring individual having to do with maybe if we do this, parents will start treating each other more civilly. I can tell you that the point of this is not to have parents being treated civilly. It's to preserve an essential privacy link between parent and child, and that's what caused me to testify before you today. So I too do believe that this will generate significant appellate litigation, and I think that privacy rights will have been abridged, and my experience in the area would tell me that likely those privacy rights will prevail. Thank you.
And I can't recall right now. I know that when it comes to minors, the court and the case law is a little bit different when you're looking at privacy rights. And I can't think off the top of my head, but, you know, it's very difficult. I echo the comments of Representative Guerra. I think we're all kind of struggling in the same place. But to me, what just keeps coming back over and over again is a situation where you would have a predator, very real situations that occur all the time, that you could have a predator or a drug dealer or, you know, you just go through the list in communication with your child, and that's the case where you're going to want to go to the next level. I mean, ideally what's happening is a parent is observing and not having to monitor and talking with their kids, and they have a good relationship. That's ideally. The next level would be that they're monitoring, but they're not going to go to the court. They aren't, as Les said, you know, they are looking at the best interests of their children already, and they're not in this vicious battle. But the case that I keep saying or thinking of in my mind is where you are going to want to go through the law enforcement process because you've got a guy or a girl or somebody who you want to prosecute, and you need that evidence. And I can't get away from that really good part of the bill to try to accommodate the other. And then I guess I just hope that judges will use their discretion and parents will as well. And I guess I might have a little more faith, but I know it can be tough out there.
Representative McGuire, this is Mike Kramer in Fairbanks. Can I speak to that for a moment?
Yeah. And then Senator Dyson, Representative Gruenberg and Senator Dyson.
Some other members of the public here in Fairbanks brought up a good point that I had forgotten, and currently we have what's called a glass warrant, and that is, you know, the police, when they believe that someone's going to make an incriminating statement over the phone, that they can go to a judge and present probable cause that this conversation is going to occur, and they can record that phone conversation pursuant to what's called a glass warrant. Those are routinely used to obtain admissions from people that have either been charged with a crime or are about to be charged with a crime, and that would fit the situation you're concerned with without creating this entirely new invasion of privacy and abrogation of parental rights and involving the government in deciding who can have communications with whom and how those various communications can be recorded and then disseminated in courts or in criminal proceedings or in any other fashion. I think, you know, we already have those protections in place, and we already have many ways that parents can monitor their children that are entirely legal and that are a matter of family's preferences, you know, within that family. If a parent's concerned about their child talking to someone on their cell phone, they have every right to get copies of those statements, to, do a number of different things. On the Internet, there's many tools available for parental controls where they can literally read and review every site that their kid goes to. And that's not something the government needs to get involved with. These are all private ways that, that parents can decide for themselves the level of intrusion they want to have into their children's lives and into their associations. And I don't agree that this bill is going to strengthen families or that it's going to actually effectively prevent criminals from contacting our children. And that's the main point. If we think that this is actually going to be successful in keeping predators away from our children in all instances, well, then, yeah, I think it would be pretty hard to speak against it. But I think it's something that sounds good, and we want to protect our children, and it's going to be hard to not vote in line with something like this. But, we have to look at the bigger picture, and I think, some good points are being made. But I just want to point out that glass warrants are already in effect. They're routinely used by law enforcement for the very situation you described. Thank you.
And I agree wholeheartedly, but much like I don't think there's going to be an all-points bulletin after the bill passes that goes out that gets parents to start monitoring on a regular basis their kids' activity, I don't think most parents are aware of the glass warrants. And I think what probably happens and what stimulated this bill is that you've got a situation where you overhear something devastating, and now you want to go forward in a prosecution or have some kind of proof of that. And sure, glass works if it's an ongoing relationship, if there's going to be continued contact, if there's a method of recapturing, if you will, that information. But let's say it's a one-time deal, or let's say it's something you can't get to reoccur, then you're in trouble because you've got to have that advance permission from the court. So I think what you're dealing with are the cases that come up and parents hear, and in this case, as Representative Cott testified, the parent goes forward and says, well, I had no idea that I couldn't offer this into evidence, and then they're told, yes, you can't. But I really respect all of your opinions, and I understand what you're getting at. Representative Gruenberg was going to speak, and then Senator Dyson is patiently waiting, and then we'll go ahead and offer amendments and then go to Senate Bill 20.
I was going to say that one way of quite easily curing the problem, I think, would be removing Section 3 of the bill, which just allows rampant wiretapping, and concentrating on Section 1, which is in the context of a criminal case, allows them to apply to a judge. And what I would offer, and I'll offer it conceptually, is to allow a warrant to issue on probable cause and allow the highlighted language to say that this may constitute probable cause. And it's a fairly simple amendment, and I can offer it conceptually or have it professionally drafted, but basically that would be it, to say that if the parent in good faith, with an objectively reasonable belief that it's necessary, signs an affidavit that may constitute probable cause. Leave it up to judicial discretion, but specifically state that may, in an appropriate case, constitute probable cause. So we would have that section, and then Section 2, which is conforming, and that would do it. And realizing also, and I'm not impinging on you, Senator, because I get to you in a second here, but that if there's an emergency, the law of warrantless searches allow, in some kind of an emergency, like you hear a predator saying, I'm going to meet you down at the corner, bring your little gym bag, and we're going to go away to Seattle, then they could do it and get a hold of the police then. That's an emergency, and there's a well-recognized body of criminal procedure to allow a warrantless search in a case like that. And we can engraft that on here either with language or with intent or legislative history, but putting it right there in a well-recognized body of law, but stating that this can, in an appropriate case, constitute probable cause. And I'd strongly support that in the bill.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks for spending time with us today.
I appreciate what I understand this bill's about, and I'd like to echo the feelings of Representative Guerra that we really got to protect parents' rights to know what their kids are doing and what they're involved in. It is a tough call. And I'd just like to bring up something that hasn't been a part of the conversation I've listened to today, and that's it. All kids are not just having the best intentions, and some children are perpetrators. And being able to know about that's really valuable. One of my foster daughters ran away at 15 and a half, and she was hooking. Had a memorable encounter with her pimp and Fred the Bell Bondsman, you probably know.
Oh, I know Fred.
At 6th and C at 3 o'clock in the morning. And at 16, she embezzled $85,000 from two fishermen that she was servicing. And she was living in my home. And I didn't know about this stuff going on. My oldest daughter, the one that was here 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago, she rescued a 16-year-old girl from a very, very bad situation. She's living in her home. This gal is just unbelievably charming and so on. Come to find out, she had said she had a bad toothache, got a prescription for Oxycontin, duplicated it, was buying it over the net and selling it both at school and in the neighborhood, and was hooking. And this all blew up when my son-in-law found a 45-year-old man wandering around their home in the middle of the night naked, and she was bringing John's home, you know, to the home. And when you, particularly if you got little kids around the house, these are probably not healthy activities you want to know about. And parents' ability to know about some of that stuff that's going on, you know, both from your own birth children and others that may be there, really important. And so I just encourage you to come down on the side when in doubt, letting parents have the ability to know and realize that kids will do some very bad things. We've had kids in our home that we didn't know until afterwards that they really got their kicks molesting younger children, you know, and one of them who, when he was frustrated, liked setting houses on fire, you know, and these are just helpful things for parents to know. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Okay, anybody else in the audience to testify? Mr. Popley? No. Okay, anyone online?
We actually would like.
Okay. So we'll close public testimony on House Bill 414. It brings it back before us to mark up. We have at least one amendment. I know Representative Grunberger's got others. Who is offering this amendment that's typed up in the packet? Is that Representative Cott? Okay. Okay, this is a definitional amendment, page 4 after line 5, adding subsection 12, defining a parent. So we'll call this amendment number 1. Do you wish to offer this at this time?
I'll offer that amendment.
Okay.
That's amendment number 1.
Amendment number 1 has been moved. Is there an objection to amendment number 1?
I just objection.
Representative Coghill?
Actually, no. I really don't have an objection to it after reading this.
Madam Chair.
Any further objection? Representative Grunberg.
I'm going to move to strike the back part of the bill. I'm not objecting if we keep the back part in to having this there, but I'm just putting on the record that it's subject to my subsequent amendment.
Boy, do I wish we could do that. I have so many motions I'd love to make like that. If I vote for this, then you'll vote for this. In any event, so noted. Representative Cott took that to heart. So is there any further objection to amendment number 1? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. Further amendments, Representative Cott, did you have any further?
No, I have.
For Representative Gruenberg.
Yes. Okay. This is a conceptual amendment here. I'm sorry I don't have it written out. On page 1, it and it would say authorizing the interception of a private enter an ex parte order, authorizing may enter an ex parte order and on line 8 after order based upon probable cause. And and it would then continue the language, the current language, authorizing the interception of a private communication. If the court determines on the basis of the application that there is probable cause, comma, which may include that. A finding that, which may include a finding that apparent blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
And when I talked to Mr. O'Hare, I said, and I would have specifically put that this on the record, that the underlined language may in and of itself constitute probable cause.
Mm-hmm.
That the court may find that is the only probable cause, and if so, that would be legally sufficient. I'm leaving it in the discretion of the court, but specifically stating that that, in and of itself, would be probable cause. The underlined language being, quote, that a parent or guardian of a minor has consented to the interception of a communication of the minor in good faith and based on an objectively reasonable belief that it's necessary for the welfare of the minor and in the best interest of the minor or that blah, 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 blah.
So, Representative Gruenberg, the intent here is to allow judicial discretion, for example, in the case of a contentious divorce battle or custody battle where a judge may look at that and
authorize it, yes.
Okay, so is that the entire of Amendment Number 2?
Yes.
Conceptual, okay. Does everybody understand the amendment? Are there questions or objections to it? Representative Guerra?
Let me just ask if we can... objection for purposes of discussion?
Sure.
Part of the amendment is to use the term probable cause instead of objectively reasonable belief?
No, that's no. In there. No. The standard remains the constitutional standard of probable cause. But under the facts of a given case, this language, the underlined language, may be sufficient to be probable cause. That could be sufficient in and of itself to constitute probable cause. And the reason I'm not being more specific, because the judge would want to know specifically what's going on and why that it is necessary for the minor that we have a wiretap and why it's in the best interest of the minor. And if the parent just said, oh, I just kind of think so, that wouldn't cut it. But if they said, you know, here they're talking to the perpetrator who has told her to meet him down at the corner with the gym bag and at 5 o'clock, I mean, so that they could look at the, like they normally do. There's a warrant, and they look and they find if there are sufficient facts to constitute probable cause. But in a given case, assuming this is well laid out, it would be in and of itself probable cause.
So if it's necessary for the welfare of the minor and in the best interest of the minor, a judge will have to allow the parent to listen, right? The judge won't have the discretion to still say no, right?
She would have the discretion to say no if the facts in the affidavit were just some vague things. Oh, I think it's in the minor's best interest, But, you know, I don't have any evidence to base that on.
As long as it's established that it's necessary to protect the child, then it'll be allowed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That if it's established in the affidavit, there are good facts, the judge would have to state that that's, to find that that's probable cause. And that's what I said in my office to Mr. O'Hare, and that's my amendment.
Okay. Representative Cott, did you have?
Shalon's unconscious trying to.
You got that?
I have it written in hand here.
Okay. Madam Chair, it's before Representative Cott answers. Could I just have him read what he has there one more time just so that I could consider it one
yes.
more time?
Yes, and I do apologize for this. Okay, on page 1, line 8. Order based upon probable cause. Pen that in. Authorizing the interception of a private communication if the court determines on the basis of the application, that's it off my comments, that there is probable cause, comma, which may include a finding that the parent or guardian, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, see, that's the part that keeps tripping me up because I heard your answer to Les, but I don't really see it that way because what you're kind of doing is you're creating a higher standard now. So the way it reads now is it would decisively give the authorization simply by meeting the objectively reasonable belief and having the good faith. But now what you're doing is you're creating sort of a higher standard, and you're saying that it may include a finding. It may not.
Madam Chair.
It may or may not.
You're right. There's a difference. What this says now is that there's no requirement of probable cause, which is a constitutional requirement.
And I understand that.
So I'm, number one, putting the probable cause. And the concept of probable cause means that a jury could find, based upon the facts of the affidavit, a certain fact. You have to have, under that constitutional requirement, judicial discretion.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm saying in there. That the judge makes the determination, and it has to meet the constitutional requirement of probable cause. Because the way this language is now, there's no requirement of probable cause, and the judge would have no discretion. I could, as a prosecutor, come up or a person could come up and just say that my client says that she or he feels that the child is going to run and that that's not in the child's best interest. There's got to be some underlying fact that will support this in a court of law.
Yeah. And I think I'm fine with it. I think what Representative Cott, if it carries, will want to do, you might, if you have an interest in it, follow it. You know, follow the issue through the courts and see how judges are ruling to see whether or not it's carrying out your original intent or not. It would be interesting to see. I think it's not a bad idea. I mean, I think it meets constitutional muster better. And I also think it allows for judicial discretion, which we don't always like. Some don't always like, but I think in this case you probably want. But I think it'd be the kind of thing, if I cared a lot about it, I would want to watch and see how judges were handling it to see whether or not it was meeting my original intent, because it may be the case that they're looking at it and saying may not every time. In that case, you know, but I think you've got good stuff on the legislative intent here at least, and I'd like to reaffirm, and then we'll get a Representative Guerra, that it would be my intent that it may include a finding, it may be some other things, but that if it does include a finding of objectively reasonable belief that it's necessary for the welfare of the minor, supported by facts and in good faith, that it would be authorized.
Absolutely my intent. So, yeah. That in and of itself would do it as long as it's necessary for the welfare of the minor and in the best interest of the minor. Those are twin in the bill as written.
Representative Guerra?
Yeah, just one more comment and then I'm ready to vote.
The issue of whether the court has discretion, Representative Kotz's aide pointed out, the statute already says the court has discretion. On line 7, the court doesn't have to issue these orders. It's already may. So it's not shall, it's may. I believe the amendment you're discussing actually gives the court the power to grant wiretaps even more often than Representative Kotz wants. Right now, the bill says only in the case where it's to protect the welfare of the minor. But by saying on line 9 that it shall include probable cause, comma, which may include,
yeah.
Now all of a sudden you're saying any sort of probable cause, one of the probable causes may include the stuff that's here, mm-hmm. but probable cause may also include other stuff that Representative Kotz didn't intend. So I think you're actually allowing more wiretapping than Representative Kotz intends, and I think the cleanest way to do what you want, Representative Grunberg, would be to use your first on line 8, you insert the words probable cause. There has to be a probable cause finding. I think that's good. I don't think you need the second probable cause on line 9, which okay.
May I respond? I did that specifically because right now under a Glass warrant, you can have probable cause that doesn't involve this. May not involve the testimony of a parent at all, may involve other evidence, may involve statements of a policeman or somebody else, OCS, Office of Child Services, and absolutely there may be other reasons.
Don't want to eliminate that.
I don't want to eliminate that. That's current law under Glass.
Fascinating. Okay, so amendment number 2 is before us, and I'd asked if there was an objection to it. Is there an objection to amendment number 2? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 2 carries. Further amendments to House Bill 414.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
For the reasons I've stated, I have lots of problems with Section 3 and Section 4, and I think the amendment adds a section. Oh, no, that's part of Section 4. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to move to strike the remainder of the bill from page 2, line 18.
And it's your intent, Representative Grunberg, to strike the definition section as well?
Because that only applies to Title 42.
That's correct. Okay.
That's a conforming amendment.
Yep. Okay, so amendment number 3 would eliminate sections 3 and 4, beginning on page 2, line 18, continuing all the way through page 4, line 5. Is there an objection to amendment number 3?
Yes, Madam Chair. There's
I would think there would be. Representative Kotz's bill has been gutted.
The bill to the point where all parents will still be conducting probably their activities within the home illegally. That was one of the issues that we were trying to get, I think, in the previous testimonies that we've heard in previous committee. I don't know about this one. I can't recall, but there was several folks that had actually said they had been violating the law because this provision is not in there. And it's my understanding, and maybe my counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, but without this in the bill, contrary to what may be out there as far as internet programs or software, you as a parent could not put that internet software. I haven't been able to find it. I understand it's online, but you would not be able to put that software online and monitor what is occurring between you and your child, number one. And number two, I think there's another part of this bill that was minimally addressed, and that is the issue not so much with divorcees, but with custodial issues. This case arose out of an issue. It's a true case where both parents had been divorced for a number of years, 6-8 years. At that initial hearing, the judge ordered that there would be joint custody. Subsequent to that, there was another case before the judge. The judge again reaffirmed the earlier order that he wanted joint custody, but as part of that joint custody, He wanted to ensure that the custodial parent, which was the person that the child was put in place in their home for the first section of this joint custody, he ordered that that parent take that child to counseling and pay for it. Subsequent to that, and he also said to both parents, my understanding, looking at over the record, that he didn't want to have any interference with that custodial parent by the non-custodial parent. It had come to light that during conversations with the child and the non-custodial parent, the child's behavior was changing dramatically, and there was things occurring in the counseling sessions that was pretty significant. So as a consequence, the parent actually listened down the conversation and found out there was a lot of mischief going on. Activities such as when you go to counseling, I want you to walk out, you know, and this is after, you know, 8 or 9 sessions. Finally, the counselor said there's no point in going any further. A counselor in Seattle, which is a child psychologist, well-renowned with a number of published books and articles, indicated that gone on any longer, there would have been irreparable psychological damage done to the child. So it was caught at a point. This whole taping issue was then turned over to the guardian ad litem, and he was furious and went back to the court, and the custody arrangement was changed. And that's how this whole thing came about.
Got it.
So in that particular case, and I don't know how many of these cases are out there, but certainly from that standpoint, I think a parent ought to have the opportunity to monitor, whether it's from predators or whatever, to ensure that that child's welfare is taken care of. And that's the whole point.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm going to respond on two levels. The first one is more of a legal level. And I don't know how a court would come out, but I think the court would be very protective of people's right of privacy here, and you've heard that. And that is somewhat aside from whether it's a good idea or not. And I am very troubled about the constitutional issue. I am also, I think the example you've raised is an example of some of a case where there should have been, you know, it was a good idea to record the conversation. And we can all, I'm sure, find stories on the other side, too. Maybe one way of solving this is to have some kind of a requirement, Madam Chair, some kind of a requirement that there be an application to the court and an order. And I'm trying to think of a way of resolving this. It may be that normally you could get an order and you could say an ex parte order, because if you have an ex parte order, the judge can always say, I'm not going to do it ex parte. I'm going to require the other side to be there. Occasionally, you may intercept the call and not have the time to go to the judge in advance, but you could go to the judge immediately after and say, I've done this, I've learned this, I want you to allow it retroactively, but to have some kind of an application to the court to allow that, either before or after. And exactly how we'd craft this, I haven't given a lot of thought. I should have given more to. But I'm wondering if Representative Cott thinks there's any merit in exploring that. Be happy to work with him on that.
Well, as this thing moves along, we're certainly happy to work with you on that. I don't know if you've had the conversation with Deborah Holbrook here in town.
I haven't talked to Debbie.
I suggest you maybe spend a few minutes with her. She's also, I think you know her,
love
her reputation and family law practitioner. So sit down with her. And
I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to do that. Let me ask you, where does this bill go? I think this is it. But let me ask you, Representative Cott. We meet next when? Tomorrow, the next day?
Friday.
Representative Cott, would you be willing to work on this with me before Friday? We come up with something on Friday?
I'd be willing to work with you on this before it comes up on the floor.
But it doesn't go anywhere before the floor.
But we can
compromise.
Can we do a floor amendment? That's fine. All right.
We can work something out.
So amendment number 3 is before us. Do you wish to withdraw?
I'm going to withdraw that on that understanding, and we'll get together with you guys.
Okay. See if you guys can continue to work something out. That would be good, because then we can keep moving with our schedule. Okay, further amendments to House Bill 414? Okay, hearing none, a motion, Representative Anderson?
Yeah, before I get to the motion, I was going to state that at 4 o'clock we have Labor and Commerce, and I realize that I bumped it back, but Representative Cott comes with me, it'll affect Senate Bill 20, so I hope we can move the bill out. You've asked me to move the bill. I move Representative Cott's bill as amended onto the House floor.
Okay, there's an objection to make a comment. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. When you're working on that, my concern is also about the parents putting the child in the middle of some kind of a divorce case. And reality in life here is that happens way more than it should be in society today. And I'm concerned about that, because it really, I don't know if we can somehow fix it so that it can't be used, but maybe there's time. Obviously, there's times that it should be, but I do have a concern about that, because parents can get so mean that they don't even think of the child, and they're just so mad at each other that they just scramble a child's brain sometimes, you know, using them against each other. And so,
Madam Chair, if you have a minute, maybe you could participate, because we can set a standard in the proposed amendment. I think we can accomplish what you want to do.
Okay, so the three of you will keep talking.
And Madam Chair, I appreciate Representative Wilson's comments. I would just state that whether or not this bill moves forward, you are still going to have parents that are going to put that child in the middle. And even though this activity that brought about this particular bill under today's statute was in violation of statute, it was basically weighed on both sides whether to go forward or not, and based on the home life, based on what was happening, it was just decided to go forward with it. Since it has gone forward, the child is now turned 180. There's no outside interference, and it's a happy kid, so.
Okay, so is the objection removed?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Anderson's motion is on the table still to move House Bill 414 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 414 is moved. That brings Senate Bill 20 before us.
And also, Representative Wilson, I see two delicious dark chocolate Easter eggs in front of you. If you don't want those, I will take them.
Yeah. Hearing no objection. Okay, so Senator Dyson.
Would you be willing to join us?
If I can work it out, yeah.
Wait, okay. You make sure that you take it.
So, let's see here. Tell us where we are. It's been a couple weeks. And then we do have public testimony. I had closed public testimony, but I'll be willing to open it up if people stay brief. Because really it's my intent to have a work session on the bill today. So I'm going to go ahead and hear from Senator Dyson, and then I will go to the folks online. But I just, again, would urge people online, I'll cut you off today. So 2 minutes each, and then my deepest apologies, but I'm extending it as a courtesy, but I don't want it to overshadow the discussion of the bill today. So without further ado, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for hearing the bill. I have had some discussions with Representative Grunberg, and we agree with him that the paragraph on page 3, line 23 through 25, is of dubious value, and we're not going to object if he asks to amend that out. And
H 4 3 lines 3 to 5.
Could you repeat that again? I'm sorry, everyone was...
That's right. Page 3, lines 23 through 25. Page 4, line 3 through 5. And so I just say that's the part that defines what a premature birth is. And so people are testifying, if that's an issue for them, it'll all probability will come out. This bill had a lot of work on the other side, and we're pretty pleased with it the way it is and eager to get it moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Okay, I'm going to start with the top of the list. I have Linda Lane. Linda, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for allowing me to testify. I am a medical anthropologist, and my specialty is pregnancy loss. I published a book on the subject, and I'm now producing an educational television series advocating for better care for women who miscarry or suffer stillbirth. Each year in the U.S., there are nearly a million pregnancy losses. The vast majority of these losses occur before 37 weeks gestation. The bill you're considering essentially criminalizes pregnancy loss. My research shows that the loss of a wish-for pregnancy is often very traumatic, and even in cases such as miscarriage clusters because of toxic exposure, women have a tendency to self-blame. So the last thing women need after loss is to be confronted by an interrogating police officer. Although the bill quite rightly exempts nearly 1 million women who have elective abortions, it leaves the equal number of women who suffer spontaneous abortions vulnerable to criminal investigation. Such investigations clearly increase distress and exacerbate the grieving process. I'm afraid this law would also undermine maternal and fetal health by discouraging women from seeking prenatal care or hospital-based births if they're afraid of arrest. And that's why every leading medical and child welfare group that's addressed this issue has unanimously opposed laws like these that would hold women legally responsible for the outcomes of their pregnancies. Furthermore, I'm afraid a bill like this would have an unfair effect on racial minorities. Black women have significantly higher rates of pregnancy loss, preterm births, and very low birth weight babies. And in the states that have similar laws, it's overwhelmingly black women who are being arrested for poor reproductive outcomes. I'm in favor of reducing violence against pregnant women, but I urge you to, rather than focusing on unborn victims, to keep the focus on pregnant women and adopt enhanced penalties for violence against them. It may be helpful to think of them of an analogy with police officers as a specially protected category. Like police officers, pregnant women provide an essential service to society, and like the police, they risk their lives in so doing. Although much less common than in earlier eras, pregnancy still brings with it the risk of death. Several hundred American women die every year because of complications during pregnancy and childbirth. And homicide of pregnant women is an even greater risk. So I support your efforts to deter such crimes, but urge you to do so by adopting legislation that enhances penalties for attacks on pregnant women rather than opening the door for making women criminally liable for the outcomes of their pregnancies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lane. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Lane. Tom Anderson speaking. Very quick question because I know we're limited on time. So with your expertise, which I appreciate your testimony, let me give you a hypothetical, and I'll have your interpretation of the way the bill currently reads, and the bill meaning Senate Bill 20, Second Judiciary.
Yes.
Let's say... which is typical, let's say, of a early 20s mother. She likes to go out and have a drink with the office gang once a month, or let's say once a week, Friday night ritual, and in doing that for 3 weeks, not knowing she's pregnant, finds out, let's say, 6 weeks later she's pregnant. Let's say it was over Cinco de Mayo or sometime where, I'm making this a little facetious, but you know, where there was, she drank a lot, and then let's say at four months, 3 months, whatever hypothetical you want to give, she has a spontaneous abortion. So you're saying the way you interpret the bill, the way it's currently written, there could be an investigation based on that.
That's right. Your item B says the birth of a child before 37 weeks gestation and gives a birth weight is prima facie evidence of serious physical injury.
Okay.
So that is exactly my concern, that women on top of their own feelings of grief for the loss of a wanted pregnancy would be subjected to criminal investigation.
Okay, and just to reiterate what Senator Dyson said, he did state that on page 4, lines 3 through 5, which you just quoted,
yes.
And then an earlier, I cite page 3, lines 23 through 25, he said he was willing to have eliminated. So would you think with those two eliminated that occurrence could still happen, that there would be investigation absent those two little sections?
I missed hearing him say that.
That makes it...
I have to reread the bill, I think, to be certain of that. But
okay.
Overall, my preference is for going the direction of enhanced penalties for violent crimes against pregnant women, rather than, I think, you open floodgates once you turn the focus towards the outcomes of pregnancies. No pregnancy is guaranteed a healthy outcome, unfortunately.
And I appreciate, Madam Chair, the reason I ask is I haven't heard the bill. I mean, because we were gone with speaking of childhood, and I have problems too with those aspects of the bill where it's so broad that if you look at Lacey Connor Peterson and the impetus That's behind it, you want to make sure that people don't harm pregnant women and ultimately kill the hopefully newborn that's coming. And
yeah.
That being said, and I'm addressing this actually to the chair, those are the areas that concern me. Thank you, Ms. Lane, for answering that question. I don't know if she answered it because she'll have to reread the bill with those two amendments gone. But I'm looking forward to hearing dialogue because I'm not thrilled with the bill the way it's currently written.
Madam Chair, just for the record, was the amendments that were talked about, were they actually, was a motion made and that was...
No, but that's a good point. I was going to say, just to save a little time today, who has an amendment to that effect? Does someone have the premature...
Ma'am, I think the two sections that
okay.
Senator Dyson and Representative Kronberg or...
Madam Chair, I can make the amendment.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and make the amendment now? The thought I have on that, although it's a bit unorthodox, is that it'll eliminate some of the testimony so that people can then confine it to what may be still around. Okay. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to move conceptual amendment number 1. Just let me know if I get this wrong, but what I'd like to do is delete page 3, lines 23 through 25, and page 4, lines 3 through 5 from the bill.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg, just to catch you up very quickly, we took a pause from the testimony to go ahead and offer the amendment. You were going to offer it, Representative Guerra just did, that deletes on page 3, lines 23 through 25, and then on page 4, lines 3 through 5, essentially the premature.
I have one. Do you want to put your name on it, too?
He just offered it.
Okay, well, you put Guerra's name on it. Here's okay. In writing.
Okay. So that's amendment number 1, and we're just taking it out of turn so that we can eliminate some of the testimony in the event it passes. Okay, amendment number 1 is before us. Is there an objection to amendment number 1? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. So for those of you who are listening online and have testimony, to the extent that your testimony would have been on the premature language, if you will, the premature 37 weeks gestation birth weight, that's been eliminated from the bill. So if you could confine your testimony to other parts of the bill that you remain concerned about or support. Representative Guerra.
Just also to help with the testimony,
yes.
Just for people who are listening, I think there's a consensus among many members of the committee that we do need to enhance the penalties that a defendant would get if they assault a pregnant woman or do even worse to a pregnant woman. And so I think you'll hear an amendment that's going to enhance the penalties if you cause a miscarriage, if you or if you injure a woman who's pregnant. And a lot of the debate will be about whether or not we should do that in a bill that uses the terms unborn child, or whether we should use it do the bill in a way where we sort of avoid the Roe versus Wade debate. But I think we're all probably going to, or at least most of us are probably going to, support something that says we do need to enhance the penalties when something like that happens.
Okay, thank you, Representative Guerra. Okay, next I'm just going down the list I have here. Again, trying to keep it to 2 minutes, please. Tomola,
It's Tiloma Jayasingha. It's an awful, Madam Chair.
Beautiful name. My apologies.
It's okay.
Okay.
I'd just like to say hello and thank you for allowing me to present to you today. I'm the staff attorney for the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, which is an organization devoted to protecting the interests of pregnant and parenting women and their families. I would like to take a moment just to quickly congratulate you, Madam Chairwoman, and your husband, Representative Anderson, on the birth of your child. I'm sure that the issues I raised today will particularly resonate with you, having been so recently within the ambit of this bill.
Thank you.
And Uncles Cott, Gruenberg, Guerra, and Cockhill, and Ann Wilson.
I'm taking into account the fact that you've now amended the bill, but the main point I want to raise is that even though that many may believe that this bill will protect pregnant women and their fetuses from abuse, because it does not make clear that it is not intended to be used as a basis for arresting pregnant women and new mothers, this bill will in fact undermine the health of pregnant women and will be very bad for babies. We know that similar bills have been used as a justification to arrest literally hundreds of pregnant women. For example, in Utah, I can say a case, there's Melissa Rowland, gave birth to twins, one of whom was stillborn. Melissa was arrested for murder for not consenting to a C-section 2 weeks earlier. What this bill says, in effect, is that women have to guarantee a healthy birth outcome. Pregnancy, as you all know, is a possibility, not a promise. No state legislature in this country has taken the step of requiring women to guarantee the outcome of their pregnancies under the threat of criminal penalties. This bill also suggests that with respect to women who are domestic violence victims, while it cannot be used alone, it can be used as a factor permitting arrest when it never should be used as a reason. Whether a woman's pregnancy is at risk because her employer won't provide her with a safer workstation, or her community won't help reduce the level of mercury in the fish that she eats, or if her boyfriend batters her, none of those should be a basis for investigating and arresting her if she can't guarantee a healthy outcome of her pregnancy. Every leading public health and child welfare group unanimously oppose the prosecution of pregnant women and new mothers, even when bills specifically target pregnant women using illegal drugs, because they understand that the threat of arrest will deter these women from seeking the care that will help them and their babies. If you are, in fact, concerned about pregnant women and their unborn fetuses, the last thing you would do is enact this bill as it's currently written, because it opens the door to the possibility of arrest to any woman who decides to continue her pregnancy to term, despite health concerns and other risks. It has actually the effect of coercing abortion rather than promoting the continuing to term. I know the person who spoke before me has also mentioned this, but enhancing punishment is the better way to go. In North Carolina, they addressed this issue in a really constructive manner by keeping the focus on the pregnant woman and acknowledging the additional loss she suffers when she and her unborn child are harmed, rather than creating a separate victim status for her fetus. These models, you know, they reflect the harmful effect the loss of a pregnancy has on the woman herself without bringing all that additional issues that arise when you make the fetus a separate victim. The way to protect the unborn and their mothers is not by opening the jailhouse door, but by promoting the alternatives that honor and protect them. This bill sends the message to women, as it's in its current draft, and I understand that you will have changes. What the message it sends to women is that if you are at risk for a premature birth, miscarriage, or stillbirth, or if you have any doubts about your ability to produce a perfectly healthy baby, abort, or else face the prospect of being arrested and sent to jail. And I'm sure that is definitely not the message. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, next I'm going to go to Allison Gottesman.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. I feel compelled today to testify not only as a constituent, but as co-chair of NASW's Social Action Committee's Alaska chapter, where we commend the thought behind this bill. stopping offenses against unborn children, we cannot support the bill as written. I can only stress the importance that the only way to keep children safe is to keep their mothers safe. I appeal to you today to amend this bill to have enhanced penalties, but not against the pregnant woman herself. There are serious fears there are serious fears that the way this bill is drafted would lock up more pregnant women than their perpetrators. I am requesting that the language of the bill be either reworked or include a statement that reads, nothing in this act is intended to grant personhood to the unborn child. I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being brief. Just as compelling being brief. Okay, next I'm going to go, it looks like in the Fairbanks LAO, there are three people from the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living. So your choice, if you each want to testify for 2 minutes or if you wanted to have one person testify on behalf of all three for 5 minutes or something like that, let me know. So in Fairbanks, the first name I have is Brenda Stanfill.
Thank you. What we'll do is we'll keep it brief because the prior speakers have done such a wonderful job and hit all the points that we had here listed to hit. We've done a lot of looking at this bill, a lot of talking about this bill, talked to a lot of you individually, and we still come back to we cannot support this bill. While we are in support of enhanced penalties and there being some recognition that a woman has lost her child, so we aren't in support of this bill as written, but we are in support of enhanced penalties. And that will wrap it up for all three of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being brief. Okay, and so just for the record to reflect, that was on behalf of the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living, Brenda Stanfill, Kate Axelaris, Jessica Stossel. Thank you guys very much for your testimony. Okay, coming to the Anchorage LAO, we have the first person I have is Clover Simon with Planned Parenthood. Clover, are you there? Ms. Simon?
Hi, this is Clover. Sorry. This is Clover Simon from Planned Parenthood of Alaska, and I know that I testified before, so I want to keep this very brief. And I guess my main concern remains with the fact that this bill does not have an exemption for acts that a woman commits. And so I guess in order for us to fully support it and to even support the enhanced penalties, that there would definitely need to be an exemption for acts that a woman does. And I read through all the other state laws. There's 32 of them about unborn victims. And the majority of them do have an explicit exemption for acts that a woman does against herself. And I think that's probably the best way to protect women from getting prosecuted under this law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Clover. Okay, next, Ann Yates.
Can I talk?
She's gone.
Okay. Pauline Richard.
Thank you. Becky.
Pauline, are you there?
She'll pass. Okay,
she's gone?
She'll pass, Madam Chair.
Okay. Joelle Hall.
Madam Chair, my name is Joelle Hall. I came today with the intent of testifying as a woman who has had a premature delivery and who would have not appreciated very much being a subject of investigation. My point being that my premature children turned up just fine. And lots of kids who have problems are born right on time. So that is, I'm glad we removed that because it's a false measurement at best. I still would urge you to consider some other way to prosecute people for these egregious crimes other than making it a separate crime itself. Thanks for letting me testify.
Thank you very much, Joelle. Michael McLeod-Ball?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I testified, Michael McLeod-Ball, I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska. And when I testified before, Madam Chair, you had questions. I was talking about the circumstance when a woman innocently took some action for which she would subject herself to criminal investigation. Your question to me was whether or not the inclusion of the recklessness standard might protect her from from that sort of investigation.
Right.
At least that's I think that was your question. And so I did a little more looking into that, and I had just a couple of comments related to that issue. So the recklessness standard is where one is aware of and consciously disregards a risk, where the disregard is a gross deviation from the standards of a reasonable person. So the question of whether a woman's behavior is reckless while at the same time might be innocent, which I think is the term I used in my testimony, is really in the eye of the beholder. So it's certainly imaginable that a zealous prosecutor could envision behavior as reckless, while others might view the behavior as understandable under some circumstances. So what happens? Well, the woman, in all likelihood, could be indicted and prosecuted by that zealous prosecutor. Even if we assume the jury interprets the standard with the degree of reasonableness that, I, for example, might apply, the woman has gone through a criminal prosecution and all the expense and stress associated with it. Recklessness is an element of the, of manslaughter, as defined in this version, and I think we're working from version U. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct.
But recklessness is not an element of the separate crime of criminally negligent homicide of a fetus. The standard for criminal negligence is where the person fails to perceive the risk. There's a requirement that the harm be caused by a dangerous instrument, but the definition for dangerous instrument is quite broad. Anything under the circumstances that can cause death or injury. So, again, the likelihood of a fact question interpreted differently by a zealous prosecutor and by a reasonable person could mean the difference between a prosecution and no prosecution. So we believe the language from version, let's see, I had some comments here based upon the fact that you were working from version R, so let me just see if I can adjust my my notes here. The additional language that would exempt a woman who remains in a violent domestic situation from the standard of extreme indifference, that's within version U, was not in version R. So that additional language of that exemption has problems of its own. First, it says that the decision to remain in the violent situation, quote, without more, close quote, cannot constitute extreme indifference. So what else beyond the decision to remain in that situation would allow a finding of extreme indifference? It seems to me that a mere scintilla of evidence added to the decision to remain in the violent situation would be enough for some prosecutors to bring a case. What if there is evidence that the woman was not in favor of the pregnancy and wanted to have an abortion before deciding to keep the pregnancy? What if she decides to drink in addition to returning to the violent home? Are those additional items that could be added to the decision to return to that violent situation and create that assertion of extreme indifference by the prosecutor? The possibilities really are endless. Secondly, there's no language that suggests that a decision to return or remain in a violent domestic situation can't be used as evidence of reckless behavior as opposed to this extreme indifference requirement. And there's nothing to suggest that it couldn't be used as evidence to establish criminal negligence. And so we would ask that that those matters be considered if this version of the bill goes forward. We reiterate our support of a different kind of bill that would include enhanced penalties. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate that. Okay. All right. Okay, next, Robin Smith.
Oh, good. I just had to turn my microphone on. I apologize. I'm Robin Smith. I'm actually a constituent of Representative McGuire's.
Yes, you are.
I also want to congratulate you on the birth of your new baby.
Thank you.
I'm here representing the Alaska Pro-Choice Alliance. We are a group of 23 diverse organizations, including Unitarian Universalist and the YWCA. We support the intent of SB 20. Men who attack and sometimes kill their pregnant wives and girlfriends should be punished more severely if the fetus is injured or dies. The most appropriate method to punish these offenders is to charge them with an enhanced penalty rather than creating a new separate crime. There are several reasons why the enhanced penalty route is preferable to a new crime. Enhanced penalties might result in longer prison terms. Enhanced penalties avoids the most problematic concept in this bill, the issue of when life begins, and the potential risk of prosecution that would, enhanced penalties would avoid the potential risk of prosecution of pregnant women which would deter them from seeking appropriate health care. So the rest of my testimony dealt with what's been eliminated, so I really appreciate the opportunity to testify here and hope you change this bill to address strictly the enhanced penalties as opposed to prosecuting the pregnant woman. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate your time and your testimony. All of you on the line, I appreciate your time today. I know you've waited a while through the other bill to testify. The next I have is Randy Magan or Megan.
It's Megan. Thank you, and I'll pass.
Okay, thank you, Randy. Okay, that's all I have in the Anchorage LAO. Is that correct, or is there anyone else that I left off on that list? Okay, good. And I don't have anyone else online. So the three that I have left are here in the room. Is there anyone else online that I didn't get to from any of the LAOs? Okay, so coming back here to the room, I have three folks. Kate Burkhart.
Members of the committee, I will address only 2 points this afternoon. The first builds upon Mr. McLeod Ball's testimony. The breadth of certain portions of the bill as written rises to a level of ambiguity and vagueness which could lead to questions of constitutionality. The well-accepted standard for ambiguity in legislation is that if a law fails to give adequate notice of the conduct that is prohibited, or if its imprecise language encourages arbitrary enforcement by allowing prosecuting authorities undue discretion to determine the scope of its prohibitions, it will fail a test of constitutionality. I know there has been plenty of testimony about unintended situations where this bill could be applied, where the conduct of a pregnant woman is actually criminalized. In South Carolina, where there is legislation similar to this, in effect, so far there have been 80 women arrested on the basis of their conduct during their pregnancy. And so the fear that this bill will indeed lead to prosecution and incarceration of pregnant women for their conduct to themselves is not unreasonable. Also, given the fact that extreme indifference to the value of human life is not actually defined, but is instead evaluated based upon a series of factors, which include the social utility of the actor's conduct, the magnitude of the risk created, the ability to foresee harm and the likelihood of harm, and the actor's knowledge of the risk, there is a great deal of breadth to what will fall within the scope of the bill. And it's for those reasons that I do believe that certain aspects of the bill, especially those dealing with manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, assault one and assault two, may fail tests of constitutionality. The other issue that I would bring the committee's attention to is that a man who assaults his wife who is not pregnant will, if he is charged, most likely be charged with a misdemeanor, whatever the extent of her injuries. That's just a fact of life. Almost every legal advocate in the state would testify to that. However, if she's pregnant and she sustains the same injuries, but there's an impact to the fetus, now it's a felony. So the public policy implications of this are that the fetus is more important than the woman, and it takes away the woman's value. The woman's value is no longer linked to her own inherent humanity, but only to the fact that she has a womb, and that certainly cannot be the point of the bill. The intent of the bill is to protect women from violence and to protect pregnant women from violence, and we know that they are twice as likely to be battered during their pregnancy as not. And so the intent is great, but as drafted, I think that the ambiguities lead to some serious constitutional questions, and the way that the penalties are set, what we're saying is pregnant women are more important than just women. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Kate. Okay, next I have Mandy O'Neill.
Good
Hi, Madam Chairwoman, members. My name is Mandy O'Neill. I'm a Juneau resident and 5.5 months pregnant. So I thought I would come today since you're talking about me. you know, a lot of the points I have are the ones that have been made by people, you know, previous. But I wanted to mention that as a pregnant woman, you worry every day about everything you do. I worry about sleeping on my stomach sometimes. I worry about my job requires me to fly. I fly in float planes. So I worry about rough landings. I worry about lots of things. That said, I don't want to add the stress of worrying about what's happening to my child. I don't want to add to that the idea that I could be prosecuted for taking that ride on a float plane for my job. I also want to make the point that there are lots of women who have high-risk pregnancies. And when you have a high-risk pregnancy, like myself, you have tons of recommendations from doctors, different recommendations from different doctors, different recommendations from your mother, different recommendations from everyone. And it's hard to tell which ones are valid and which ones you really need for your baby. So I have to make that decision all the time for myself. I understand that there are risks in being pregnant and that there's no guarantee of a positive outcome. But what I need is respect from everyone that I can make those decisions and that you can teach me, you can educate me, and give me information, and I'll be able to do those without the fear of prosecution. Because the fear of prosecution will keep me from seeking out those educational opportunities. I also just want to point out that without me, you know, without my input and without my work, there is no baby. I mean, he's just an idea. So if you want me to be safe and you want him to be safe, the best way to do it is to go through me because there's really no other option. Okay. Thank you
very much for your testimony.
We want him to be a Leo. Have him in late July or August.
To July 26th.
You're in luck.
Are you
Thank
a Leo?
You, Mandy. Yeah, Tom's a Leo. Remember, Leos think everyone should be a Leo. That's the thing about Leos.
My son's a Cancer.
Yeah. Cancers don't think like that, see?
No, they're crabby.
The next and final person I have is Sarah Lynn
Tabachnik. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, Executive Director of AWARE, Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies here in Juneau, and to express some concerns about this bill. This bill seems to carry greater concern for the unborn child than for the woman carrying the unborn child, as if the cargo has greater value than the vessel. And it puts pregnant women at risk for all sorts of consequences in the event she miscarries, delivers a stillborn child, or her baby is born with physical injury. This bill does not speak about the pregnant woman experiencing this loss. When pregnant women are injured during domestic violence, the intent is often to cause physical and emotional harm to the pregnant woman. Crimes against pregnant women, because they are pregnant, are crimes against women, and stopping violence against women stops violence against future children as well. I wholeheartedly support legislation that protects pregnant women and their future children. I support legislation that enhances penalties on attacks of women who are pregnant. I support legislation that acknowledges and punishes the additional loss and harm experienced by pregnant women. I support legislation that prohibits the shackling of women who are pregnant and already in jail. I support legislation that promotes pregnant women's health through advocacy of healthy behavior, including the development of safe and available and effective services for women and families when substance abuse treatment and mental health services are necessary, and mandatory training for medical providers in miscarriage management, including interpersonal violence training and screening. Pregnant women in safe shelter or in violent relationships are in highly stressful situations, and we work to support and encourage them with healthy coping alternatives. And we also understand that every woman survives violence in her own individual way. Adding to her confusion and fear by threatening criminal prosecution will cut off more women from seeking the support they need. I urge you to create legislation that protects pregnant women rather than place them at risk. Please send the message that violence against pregnant women is unacceptable and that those who assault them will be aggressively punished by instituting enhanced penalties for these crimes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here in the audience that I've overlooked that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 20? Okay, hearing none, I will close public testimony on Senate Bill 20. That brings the bill back before us for amendments and discussion. I have two amendments, no names. One has a lot of white space. One has a lot of verbiage.
That's an amendment to the amendment.
Okay. That's an amendment to the, so amendment number two will be Representative Guerra.
I'm going to move amendment number one, which at the top says.
Number two. Because remember, we already did.
We already did one. Oh, okay.
You're premature.
Right. Thanks. I'm going to move amendment number two, which is the bigger amendment. It starts at page one, line one, delete all material, and insert an act enhancing penalties for crimes committed against pregnant women.
Okay.
And before we discuss amendment number two, I'd like to move amendment number one to amendment number two, and that's the one-page amendment that you have in your hand that starts at page one, line 15. There were, and I'll explain that as time passes, if you'll just do me the courtesy of letting me get amendment number one to amendment number two into
sure.
the amendment.
Why don't you just introduce it as amended? You mean it sort of amend your own, or state it as, this is amendment two and it shall include this.
Sure.
And then go ahead and explain to us what that inclusion will mean.
Sure. I guess that technically makes it conceptual. So amendment number two is the longer amendment that I discussed, and then it's amended by the one-page amendment that starts at page one, line 15.
Okay. And in essence, the amendment to it, is there a way to summarize it? Is
sure.
it more technical in nature or?
With the amendment, the intent of the amendment is to impose stiffer sentences against people who assault or even do worse to pregnant women, to impose for the assaults where the person knows that the woman is pregnant, to impose a sentence of at least as long as the sponsor's bill does, and then to also add a provision. And so what the body of the bill does with most of that second second amendment, what the body of the bill does is it creates a new crime for most of these serious crimes and says that crime shall be punished as a level higher crime than it is right now. So what used to be a Class B felony is a Class A felony. What used to be a Class A felony is an unclassified felony. And what used to be an unclassified felony now is an unclassified felony with a much higher sentence. So that's what... That's what the amendment to the amendment does, and it says for the crimes where you don't cause a miscarriage or a stillbirth, if you knew or you should have known that the woman was pregnant when you committed your crime, we're going to enhance your sentence with an aggravator. So that's the last part
but
of
the first part is a separate crime, not an aggravator.
Right.
But the second part, if there isn't the result isn't death, essentially.
Yes.
Then there's an aggravator.
Yes.
Okay.
So everything you have is except for those last three lines, everything that you have is about the amendment that says what used to be a Class B is an A, what used to be an A is an unclassified. And then the only part that's just simply an aggravator is the last part. And then I can go through it.
Okay, so why don't you go, so the amendment has been moved as amended, and is there an objection to the amendment?
I'll object.
Okay, so there's an objection noted, and so Representative Guerra, do you want to pick up where you left off in your explanation of the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd appreciate some latitude. This really is going to be the debate about the bill,
yes,
as far as I intend. I've got a series of other amendments, which I hope we don't have to get to, but we'll see. Otherwise, this is the only one I intend to offer. I think the sponsor of the bill, and I agree on one major point, and I believe a major part of the bill, which is that there should be enhanced penalties, more serious penalties, greater sentences when you attack, murder, assault a pregnant woman, and cause a miscarriage. And I think where we differ then becomes whether, in addition, we want to use language in the bill that might be used to reverse Roe versus Wade. And and I think where we also differ is there's more points to where we differ, and at some point the sponsor will come up and address those.
Senator Dyson, you want to...
I think that he would say, I think he would also say that we want to recognize also the separate life of as in the bill states, an unborn child.
Can I help, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, so maybe I shouldn't have actually sort of invited but actually, in fairness to Senator Dyson.
For you?
Sure, Representative Anderson.
And I'll bring you my issue. I've been in office 4 years. I was on the school board 1 year. We have had, even when it's not relevant for assembly or school board or municipal light and power commission, things I've served on purview, I've received questionnaires from pro-life and pro-choice groups. And we all know where Senator Dyson stands, and to a degree I'm proud of his advocacy, his passion, and I applaud him for his being a purist on in this case, protecting unborn life and being that label pro-life. That being said, the rationale, and getting to Representative Guerra's question, I think, the rationale for the bill, in my opinion, is a response to deaths, heinous deaths, such as Lacey Connor Peterson and her child, where, in this case, Scott Peterson killed the child, and you want prosecution at the highest level. Of course, in your sponsor statement, you state it protects unborn children. Scott Peterson didn't give a blank that his wife was pregnant. This wouldn't deter him if you gave him a 50-term life sentence. So I think in terms of the testimony, and to my focal point that Senator Dyson can respond to, I think the spirit of the testimony, some of the folks that testified are extreme left pro-choice. I want to tune them out, but I can't do that as a policymaker. Others, on the other hand, are so rigid on the other side, I sit in the middle, if there can be one. I think the hardcore pro-lifers and hardcore pro-choicers will say, there is no middle. Well, I think there is. That's where I am. And when I look at the spirit of the bill, and then he can respond, I look at it being to protect women, someone had mentioned that, and protect pregnant women from violence. And when you get into definitions, Section 5, of what an unborn child is, or when you focus on an unborn child over the pregnant woman, which I believe this bill has a tendency to do, and not by design or malice, but maybe you have an ulterior motive, in your opinion, a good motive to define other things in the bill, I think we stray away from that issue of when you hurt someone that's pregnant, and you do that knowing they're pregnant, you should be, similar to the cop analogy, penalized even more so because you knew that and you harmed them. And I hope it wasn't your intent for that. We've heard analogies, someone driving, someone partying not knowing they're pregnant, someone skiing, hardcore skier. I can think of those who repeatedly hardcore skis and they're pregnant and they end up hurting the baby, that they would be prosecuted would scare me. So maybe you could, with that introduction of my confusion...
Wes, is that what you would have said?
Oh. No, I just. I'm sure what Representative Anderson. That was actually great, and I appreciate it. You said it better than I did. It's up to the chair. It's up to what you want to do. I do want to explain the amendment, and I think I stumbled when I started speaking for Senator Dyson when I shouldn't have. And as I started doing that, I realized all of a sudden I was on shaky ground.
That's so. The reason I was trying to. To kind of come back to you is to allow you to, and then to, because I always then go directly to the bill's sponsor to find out how they will receive the amendment. But why don't we just allow you to officially, but keep Senator Dyson here, to officially finish describing the amendment, and then we'll continue, have Senator Dyson respond, and then any other comments regarding the amendment, because it is unusual in the sense that this amendment sort of is the heart of the bill. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment... takes the crime of assault, the crime of murder, the crime of manslaughter, the crime of murder two, all of those crimes, and says if done knowingly against a pregnant woman, if you cause a miscarriage or a stillbirth, your sentence will be much greater than if the woman was not pregnant. So what it does... from murder one all the way down to a Class B misdemeanor, it takes every one of those crimes and moves them up a level of crime, as I discussed before. Current law, to some strong degree, already recognizes the interest of a woman who's pregnant in not being assaulted. And it says what is normally a garden variety of assault if you cause a miscarriage. The law already says a miscarriage constitutes automatically serious physical injury. So when you cause a miscarriage, what was a garden variety assault becomes a Class A felony right now, even if it was reckless and unintentional. So let's be clear about what current law does. There is some recognition in the law already for when you cause a miscarriage, when you assault somebody, or worse. But it doesn't go far enough. There are a few problems with the bill. One is just the philosophical debate that we're going to have about whether or not we should use language that, and I don't think I'm saying anything out of line. I think there's language in this bill that a lot of people want to use as a vehicle then to challenge Roe versus Wade. And so the bill right now uses the term unborn child, unborn child, unborn child. And I think that legal analysts will say that when a state passes laws using those words, that will give those who want to reverse Roe versus Wade a greater chance in court to do that. So we've decided we're going to do a bill that protects against assaults against women or worse where you cause a miscarriage, but we're going to stay away from the Roe versus Wade debate. We can have that on another day. Another problem with the bill, as I see it, is on page 2, I think it does criminalize the pregnant woman. And if you look at page 2 of the bill, starting at line 26, there is now in the bill a crime called criminally negligent homicide of an unborn child. And it says you can be charged with that homicide if, with criminal negligence, you cause a miscarriage or as the bill says, create a homicide of an unborn child by means of a dangerous instrument. The courts have said a car is a dangerous instrument. It would be negligent for you to drive 85 miles an hour, get into an accident, and hurt not only yourself, but terminate your pregnancy, cause a miscarriage, cause a stillbirth. The woman who is pregnant would be charged not only with the crime against herself, but a separate crime for causing her own miscarriage. And I personally believe, with all due respect, that adds a sort of injury to injury to the woman, a psychological one in addition to all the others. I don't think it is right for us to come up with a new way to criminalize conduct by a pregnant woman who does not intend to harm her child. So I have problems with that part of the bill. So let me go into what the amendment does. The amendment does two things, and originally I thought did something, and I ran it by Ms. Carpinetti, and she explained to me that there were some flaws to it, and that's why you had the amendment to the amendment. It intends to take the crimes that, starting from assault of a pregnant woman all the way up through murder of a pregnant woman, and impose a sentence of at least as harsh as the sponsor would impose, and in some cases harsher, so in some cases a greater sentence. It only imposes them in cases where the person committing the assault, or worse, has reason to know that the woman is pregnant. So if you know the woman's pregnant and you assault her, you do worse to her, you're going to be punished much more seriously than you are under current law. And then there's a second part of the bill that says even if you didn't cause a miscarriage, your sentence is going to be enhanced. Going through the amendment, what we're going to do is in cases of murder one, where you cause a miscarriage, we're going to impose a sentence of 40 years to 99 years. The bill right now proposes a new crime that would be 20 to 99 years. If you add the new crime in the bill to existing law, which would be a crime for assaulting the woman, that's also 20 to 99 years. You add those two crimes together, that becomes, under the bill, 40 to 99 years. Our bill says, therefore, if you do this, it's 40 to 99 years, the functional equivalent.
And Madam Chair, just let me ask, in the amendment, Representative Guerra, so what you're saying is someone's pregnant, you shoot them with intent to kill them, and their baby, then you're escalating the penalty that's currently in the bill. And the reason you're escalating it is, again, because the mentality there is that the lady's pregnant.
Well, hopefully you would just get life if you did that. So, but right, the bill would say minimum 20 years for the shooting the woman, minimum 20 years for causing the miscarriage. We just say it's one crime and it's 40 to 99 years. Murder two, currently the bill says it's 10 to 99 years. The sponsor of the bill says, again, there are two crimes, one against the woman, one against the unborn child, 10 to 99 for each. We make it 30 to 99 for causing the miscarriage in murder two. So our bill probably imposes a larger penalty than the sponsor does in that circumstance. Manslaughter, the bill says it should be 5 to 8 years, up to a maximum of 20 years. We turn it into an unclassified felony, which goes up to 99 years. Criminally negligent homicide and assault two, the bill says it's a minimum of 1 to 3 years, a maximum of 10. We say make it a Class A felony, and that changes the crime that used to be 1 to 3 years to 5 to 8 years. It changes the maximum of 10 years to a maximum of 20 years. Assault three, the bill says jail time can be as little as 0 years and as high as two. Two crimes, double 0 years, would still be zero. It's hard to know what a judge would do just sitting here. So we take what used to be 0 to 2 with a maximum of 5 years in the bill, and we make it 1 to 3 years with a maximum of 10 years in our amendment. Assault four and reckless endangerment. The bill says a maximum of 1 year, and we move it to a Class C felony, which moves it to a maximum of 5 years. Then the last part of the bill says, as I mentioned before, these are for crimes where you know the woman is pregnant, you still assault her, you still do worse to her, and you cause a miscarriage or a stillbirth in addition to the injury to the mother. Then we say, even in addition to those crimes, if you commit any crime out there and it's to a pregnant woman, and you have reason to know she's pregnant, we don't even want to have to prove that you caused any kind of injury to the fetus. Sometimes we won't know, and we don't want the prosecution to come and have to debate whether you caused injury to the fetus. You've sort of lost your argument to me if you've assaulted a pregnant woman in the first place. So we say in those cases, regardless of whether there's a stillbirth, regardless of whether there's a miscarriage, there is a sentence aggravator, and your sentence should be aggravated just for assaulting a woman or doing something to a woman who is pregnant, regardless of whether you injure the fetus at all. So that's what the amendment does. It imposes stiffer, as stiff or stiffer penalties against this kind of conduct directed at pregnant women than the bill does. It leaves aside the issue of where you didn't know the woman was pregnant and do something to her. We can address that additionally. I think what I really want to get at, and I think what we really want to get at, is when people not only consciously endanger women's lives in the first place, but if you endanger a woman's life and you're so callous that you're going to do it even though she's pregnant, I think there are going to be grave consequences for what you do. And that's the aim of the bill. And the other aim of the bill, and I hope we can respect this, is if we're going to have a debate about Roe versus Wade, let's have a debate about Roe versus Wade. If we're going to try and rewrite the Constitution, let's have a fight about that separately. But I don't want to, under the auspices of a bill aimed at protecting pregnant women, also end up passing something that, by the way, asks the courts to reconsider Roe versus Wade. I'm just not going to go there. I'm going to go as far as protecting women. I'm going to go as far as protecting pregnant women. I'm going to go as far as protecting pregnancies, because that is the right thing to do. I don't think that today and for the rest of the session we should start fighting about abortion.
Okay. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I didn't get a chance to see this amendment before just now, and I sure would not have done that to you, Representative Guerra, and I consider that kind of a breach of professional courtesy, and I will never do that to you, you know, and I'm disappointed.
I appreciate it.
And The original bill, as I submitted, did have the clause in it that nothing in this bill would allow a woman to be prosecuted for what she did to herself. If you all change it back to my original bill, I won't strongly object to that. There were people on the other side, and we fought that through, and they wanted to have the protection for the unborn child against the reckless conduct that a woman did, dangerous instrument, against her child. Much of the testimony here that really didn't get to the heart of this bill, which was, does an unborn child, is it worthy of protection in this country of ours? It is now under federal law. It is in 28 other states. And this idea that that unborn child isn't worthy of protection under this state's law is highly offensive to me. If you amend this bill so that it does not include two crimes, a crime against the mother and the unborn child, and I don't have the votes to get it changed on the floor, I will withdraw this bill. And I'll tell the world that in this state, an eagle's egg has more worth and is more worthy of protection than an unborn child. And I will be ashamed that this state does not think that an unborn child is worthy of its protection under law. Ms. Carpinetti and I have had long discussions about each one of these clauses here whereby the damage to an unborn child, whether it's reckless or not, and she can explain the very careful language that she has put in here that makes prosecution very unlikely, and she can do a far better job than I can do about that.
Senator Dyson, just to very briefly, so in your original bill, tell me, because I don't have it here, how it read that the woman would be exempted from.
Maybe somebody here has got it, but it basically was another paragraph in it said nothing in this bill will allow a woman to be prosecuted for things she does to herself that damages the child.
That was in the French amendment.
Okay, including, so that includes the reckless, the stuff we've been talking about.
That's my memory of it, but my memory of that is faulty. But the gut cutter here is if you eliminate a crime, a second crime here, we're done. I'm out of here, and you guys can do whatever you want with it. I don't have the votes on the floor to do it. We're out of here. And the whole purpose of this bill, to establish that an unborn child has intrinsic value of its own, we'll go.
I'm also going to do something just a little unorthodox as well that I want you to think about, and as we continue discussing it, because I'm sensitive to the fact that you feel sort of that you weren't presented with the opportunity to look at the amendment. And that happens sometimes in the ebb and flow of legislative. I'm going to testify to Representative Guerra's integrity and believe that he's busy and things have been moving quickly. And so in light of that and out of respect for you as a person and as the bill sponsor, I would be willing, should you choose, to bring the bill first thing up Friday to allow you a couple of days to sort of process what this amendment is. Okay.
Unnecessary.
Okay.
Once you make the decision that it's not two crimes, the bill has lost its value. Back to the language, it was in the A version. It said it does not apply to acts that, paragraph 3, are committed by a pregnant woman against herself and her own unborn child. That was my original bill.
Okay.
And
so those are any. So that's the intentional, the reckless, and it's broad.
Yeah, that's okay. Exactly right.
Okay.
That was not a battle that I chose to fight for some of the very reasons that come up here. But my colleagues felt strongly about it, and I'm sympathetic to that perspective.
Do you have that on a piece of paper or something that?
And Madam Chair, I just have a question.
Representative Anderson, thank you.
Senator Dyson. We've heard too many folks testify and give scenarios or hypotheticals. You've heard them, the drinking, the skiing, the car driving. What is your response to that? Because that's where I don't support the bill. Because if there's the potential of that, I mean, that's too broad. And you can use the eagle's egg analogy. I don't agree. It's not analogous to this. So can you explain how those individuals aren't adversely affected if the bill passed? Or maybe I'm misreading it. I mean, maybe with the two amendments you took out, I mean, I'm starting to get confused, to be honest. Because I'm trying to read the bill quickly with limited time to figure out, with the amendments that you endorsed at the beginning, the page 3 and the page 4, or 4 and 5, 3 and 4, is there still that potential?
Okay. As I just said, that my original bill had a clause in there that said a woman could not be prosecuted for anything she did to herself, a pregnant woman. So it eliminates all of those issues.
That was taken out?
Yes.
Apparently it was taken out in the Senate judiciary.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't have your original bill, but I saw in the Senate judiciary it went.
That's right.
Yes, would you please, Annie? Annie's going to make a copy. Check with, when you go out there, check with Shalon by the copier. She may have something. Okay, yeah.
Well, I've got an amendment here if this thing fails. Okay.
But my staff just pointed out to me, if you choose to go that route, I don't recommend it, but if you choose to, there's several other amendments that have to be made to take out some language that's in there,
okay,
if that's what you choose. But if you accept the amendment that's before you, all these discussions are moot.
Okay. Representative Gehr, I had you next, and then Wilson is next after you.
I need to address a couple things. Senator Dyson, I do apologize. And let me explain to you how this slipped through the cracks. I think it's very important. You had the courtesy to call me the summer about the bill and say, let's see if we can work something out.
Well, thank you.
And at the time, I believe I said I preferred the approach that Senator French tried on the Senate side, which is the same exact approach we're taking here. So I didn't intend to sandbag you. The amendment here with that one-page correction, which we just figured out about an hour and a half ago, the amendment here is the same one that was debated on the Senate side. So we didn't, with that, the fact that we had talked about it, couldn't find common ground, the fact that I had spent some time with Representative Coghill with the same amendment that we're addressing here, couldn't find common ground, it totally slipped my mind to, and you and I then didn't talk the session about this bill. We didn't come to each other's offices about the bill. But with all that, it completely slipped my mind. I should have gone to you with this amendment again. But it's also not like we hadn't talked about it. So if there was a breach, it was a smaller breach than I think you thought it was. And when you mentioned it, I thought it was as big a breach as you mentioned until I just started thinking about what had happened over the course of the last 6 months.
Yeah, I would have enjoyed a copy an hour ago or 2 hours ago or whatever it was.
I do apologize. And the second page is something we figured out this afternoon, and I should have run that part by you. You're absolutely right. Bite my lip. There are majority members who don't ever exhibit that courtesy to me when I'm in committee, but I try and exhibit the courtesy. And you've always exhibited the courtesy to me.
Representative Wilson.
I want to go to one other thing.
Representative Garrett.
This one's going to be harder for me. I don't mean any disrespect by not technically having a second crime with a second name for when you cause a miscarriage. That doesn't mean that we do not value a woman's pregnancy or the baby that she's carrying. Just like it doesn't mean we don't value the lives of the victims who survive somebody who was killed in a murder. When you murder somebody, and as you know, that has occurred in my family. When you murder somebody, the crime is murder. There is no separate crime because the victim had a son, a daughter. There is no separate crime for each victim in the family who remains alive. The crime is called murder. When we've developed the crime of murder, we meant no disrespect to the interests of those people who still survived, who were in some way hurt almost as much as the person who died. So I do not agree with the argument that just because we don't have a separate named crime for every victim of a murder or assault, we somehow disrespect all of the victims. I don't buy it. And I say that in a manner that's a little bit emotional, A, out of my own experience, and B, because I take some offense. I take some offense that you believe that I think one crime is just like another crime. So I would ask you to think about the fact that we impose the same sentences you want to impose, and really our difference is one of language. But I don't disrespect the fact that a woman who has a miscarriage has lost a baby. I value that as a separate interest. And then this whole thing about what language you're using, I'm sorry that we disagree about the use of the word unborn child. Unfortunately, I know that that language is being used, frankly, because of the broader abortion debate. Maybe not because, but it's going to have an impact on the broader abortion debate. That's why I'm trying to avoid it. I don't consider somebody after they've been born a born child. I consider them a child. And frankly, I personally consider somebody that a woman is carrying during a pregnancy a baby. That's what I consider it. Because I don't look up my Black's Law Dictionary when I come up with these terms. I don't know what the technical word should be. I just know how I speak. So I don't think we need to have this fight about what you should technically have to call somebody, but the touche to you when you tell me that I'm not properly recognizing the interest of a baby because I don't call it an unborn child, I would tell you I also don't call a baby who is born a born child. So I don't feel guilty for not calling a baby an unborn child. So there, that was hard.
May I respond?
Yes, Senator
Dyson. I appreciate and respect the pain you've been through. And so on. But this whole idea that you just have lost something in value. I mourned with my middle daughter. And we wept when she lost two children. She and I believe she lost something of value. It wasn't just a pregnancy. There's two more grandkids of mine I don't have. This is... this gal and her dead son, when she buried him. Her husband beat her until the child died within her and was born stillborn. When she finally crawled out of the home and got help, they took her to the hospital. She delivered a dead child. She said, "My own injuries are life-threatening. I nearly died. I spent 3 weeks in the hospital. During the time I was struggling to survive, the legal authorities came and spoke to my sister. They told her something she found incredible. They told her that in the eyes of Wisconsin law, nobody had died on the night of February 8th. I don't know how we can say that it's not a homo sapien child that died. And if you choose to eliminate the second crime here, that's a statement the people of this state get to make through their elected officials. That's your choice. But I feel very strongly about it. 20 other states have done it on one level, and it's in federal law. Various polls run between 56 and 82% of how many people think that if you kill a child while you're assaulting its mother, you get two victims. It's your choice.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator, you made the comment. I've got some concerns about the testimony. I'm not concerned about your bill in the way what you want it to be. I don't have a problem with that. I do have. I am concerned about some of the wording. But you said that Carpinetti could explain that better than you, and I would like her to explain it so I feel better about it. That's my concern, is with the recklessly and negligent. Those concern, I have a little bit of a concern, because I don't want anybody to be in trouble with this bill unintentionally. And if she could come up and ease my mind about it, that would help me make a decision for this amendment.
Madam Chair. just as the point of order, the amendment before us probably should be dealt with before we get there, because it may change the whole nature of that discussion.
However, in order for me to make, in order for me to make a decision about the amendment, I would like to. I don't feel like I can until I feel comfortable that if okay. with those two words.
And okay. I regularly, you know, allow latitude in this committee, and I can't imagine that on a day with such an emotional topic that I would suddenly decide not to extend that latitude to members of the committee for whatever information they need to help make their minds up. And procedurally, it's probably a little unorthodox, but if it helps Representative Wilson, then by all means, let's have the testimony. Representative Kott?
Yeah, before maybe Ms. Carponetti comes up, I have a question for Fred. Fred, in your opening remarks, you said this, whatever we end up doing has to consist of providing two things. One is protection of the mother and protection of the unborn. Is that what you said? Did I capture that right?
Yes, sir.
And in your original bill, I'm just trying to work this thing through, your original bill as introduced, where you had that provision in there that basically said that if committed by a pregnant woman against herself or her own unborn child was exempt, how do you get to the second part of that? Because you're not protecting the unborn child.
Excellent question. Yep.
And that version.
Yep. Yep.
You're there. But.
Yep. And that was the very argument that happened in Senate Judiciary that got the version here, because they wanted to continue to protect that unborn child against some egregious kinds of behavior. And I think Ms. Carponetti will tell you that it was her opinion that the standards for charging that woman were high, you know, so. And it would be unlikely that there would be frivolous charges brought against her unless.
Ms. Carponetti.
We're going to ask you to continue with the unless.
And Madam Chair, the second comment I wanted to make for Fred is if no matter how this bill ends up in a way that is not looked favorably by the sponsor, it can't be withdrawn until it gets back over your side.
Former rules chairman twice, reminding you, and speaker.
But you certainly don't have to request it to be heard on the floor either. It's a choice of words.
Ms. Carponetti.
Well, I will say that you give me too much credit, Senator Dyson does. I didn't write this bill. James Crawford did from Ledge Legal. But I have worked on it, and it actually tracks a lot of our current murder and assault statutes. The language is not a lot of the terms, for example, there was some testimony about what is extreme indifference to the value of human life. That is part of murder too right now. So that term has been applied. That's not new language that might be hard to for a court to apply or for prosecutors to make reasonable decisions on. So with that said, what can I try and help you with?
Well, some of the testimony that was given earlier, when they talk about reckless or negligent, you know, it's made sense to me with some of the things they said that a woman could possibly be put in prison for or something like that. So I just want some reassurance that couldn't happen.
Well, through the chair. I'll tell you what negligence, how it's defined in our criminal law, and that is not acting. Well, let me just read it to you because it's really well written in our statutes.
May I? I think, Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I think you may want to give an example. I think maybe you're referring to the fact, and I'm kind of talking to you, Ms. Carponetti, that a woman is, for some reason, driving negligently, and as a result causes an accident that causes a miscarriage. Would that be then criminal negligent homicide of an unborn child? I think that's the kind of example Representative Wilson's talking about.
An eighth month or something, and most of us wouldn't do it, but maybe she does it every day. I mean, so I just want some assurance that these weird things aren't going to happen.
Yeah, she's skiing. Yeah, skiing negligently or something. But
through the chair, she's driving 50 on a 30-mile-an-hour road that's icy because she's late for another child's baptism. Meaning, it's still negligent regardless of the reason she's driving fast, and she's driving too fast and on ice, and she gets in a wreck. She certainly didn't intend to miscarry her child that she's pregnant with. So, what would happen?
Well, and if I may, this is one of the things that helped me all the way through this stuff. Really, the charges the woman might face for what she does to her unborn child is no different than if that child was born and sitting beside her. So if she's driving recklessly and with careless disregard and has an accident and it kills her child or injures her child, under, as I understand our statutes that we're putting before you here, she could be charged for that.
It's the same as it is now.
Yeah, yeah. Only that the place the kid isn't sitting in a baby carrier strapped in; it's inside of her. But it's the same sort of standard that we were interested here in, and I hope we accomplished that. I'm sorry.
Sure. No.
Representative Anderson.
The chair. So right now, if the scenario I just gave, if she got in a wreck driving icy 30-mile-an-hour zone, she's driving 50. Whatever the reason she's going there, let's say she's not drinking, and it's determined as negligent, and what was the standard? Reckless?
Well, there's one that's negligent.
So you're saying that and the baby died in a miscarriage, she was injured, but the baby died, then she would be charged for that. I didn't realize that.
Through the chair, that would be very unlikely that she would be charged. Because, yeah. You know,
but this bill, the way this bill is written, she would be now.
Well,
no, uses criminal negligence. It recites criminally negligent homicide in the same way as current laws. That is, and I'll read it to you, a person acts with criminal negligence with respect to a circumstance, which would be the death of the child, I think, when the person fails to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur and that the circumstances exist. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that the failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the circumstances. So your example about a woman driving too fast over icy roads, I don't think we would bring that charge because I don't think it rises to criminal negligence. I don't think it reaches that level. Criminally negligent homicide, we often prosecute drunk driving when you kill somebody. Or depending on the circumstances, it could be manslaughter because the conduct is reckless. Or you could even get sometimes murder in the second degree for drunk driving that causes a wreck and kills.
Wilson, Guerra, and then Gruenberg.
So basically, we're not changing any law whatsoever that is in statute right now at all, except that we're saying if a child died, we're just saying that an unborn child can be counted as a murder, where before, right now, it can't. That's the only thing we're changing. The criminally negligent homicide is in our law now, and so we're not changing
it. It's a little bit different from what is in our law, because this bill provides requires use of a dangerous instrument, and I think under current law, criminally negligent homicide does not require that the harm occur through a dangerous instrument.
The car is a dangerous higher standard.
Okay. That makes me feel better. That answers my
Representative
question.
Garrett and then Gruenberg.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wilson, I think we've gone round and round. Ms. Carpinetti, tell me if I'm correct about this. Right now, if you get into a car accident, that would be a criminal negligence. If you get into a car accident, airbag goes off, you get a bruise in your face, bruise in your stomach, causes a miscarriage. Right now, that's negligent driving. Under Senator Dyson's bill, since you're causing the miscarriage, this now becomes murder. So that's the difference, is that now it gets charged as two things, the negligent driving against the woman, and then the murder because she's caused her own miscarriage. That's a big difference, and I think I've got that right. So currently, no murder charge. Senator Dyson's bill passes, murder charge.
Madam Chair.
Can I ask Ms. Carpinetti if I have that right?
I think you do. I mean, because under current law, there's the current law for homicide doesn't consider the fetus a person. So, yes, but if the child is sitting next to her is killed, that would be another story.
Representative Gruenberg.
I think people need to look at the second judiciary CS, page 2, lines 26 to 29. A car would be a dangerous instrument. And it's a Class B felony. I think that's equivalent to a manslaughter. It's not equivalent to a murder, right?
Criminally negligent homicide is a B felony. Manslaughter is an A felony. And murder is an unclassified felony.
So it's even less. It's equivalent to criminally negligent homicide, this statute here, page 2, lines 29, 26 through 30. There was a situation. I'm going to give a situation that involves somebody we know. Somebody drives an overloaded dump truck and at an intersection wipes out a number of people. That was a circumstance, and I thought that guy, that was by Spinard Builders at Tudor in Minnesota a number of years ago, wiped out a father and a son. I thought that was a negligent situation. I thought the guy got charged with criminally negligent homicide. But I think that in an appropriate case, depending on what the person is doing, it has to be criminally negligent. But if it's criminally negligent and you kill somebody and it's a driving situation, they can charge you under current law if you have the baby strapped in next to you or in the back seat, wherever it is, with criminally negligent homicide. And what this does, I think the intent is simply to say, even if the baby is not yet born, but it's inside in gestation, in utero, you can be charged the same as if the baby's next to you.
And you know, the difficulty, I was just sitting here thinking with this bill, I had a class in college called rhetorical theory, and it's a lead up to law. We studied about something called casuistry, which is an early practice of law by religious pastors and priests. And the idea behind it was that the religious person, practitioner, would take the circumstance that the individual was involved in plus the tenets of their faith, the values that they employed, such as life and so on, and then equal the result. And the result would be different depending upon the same value being involved in five different scenarios, but plus a circumstance equals a result. And so the idea was that we don't have that necessarily that method of doing that anymore. And so we sit here as lawmakers and we try to carve these black and white laws that apply to everyone, and we leave out some of these other circumstances. And I think that's what we're struggling with today, is that I don't think there's a person on this committee, in fact I know there isn't a person on this committee, that doesn't value life, both of women and of babies. I can say that wholeheartedly. And but then where you draw the line, where you push that line is very difficult, because we want to be careful that women aren't seen as mere vessels, that they are lives and that they have their own life and their own worth, and that the choices they make are worthwhile and important and difficult. You heard the pregnant woman that testified earlier, and I've just experienced it. You do worry every single day that what you eat has enough nutrition and that you're not overworking yourself, but then if you don't work, how do you make a living and provide for your child? It's unbelievable. And so I sit here today, Senator Dyson, and I feel the pain of my committee because in some ways, you know, the amendment achieves part of, I think, the concern, but gets us away from this other respect of unborn life, as you referred to it. But then if we keep the bill the way it is, you end up in circumstances where I think you have women hopefully acting in good faith, making choices that may lead to their imprisonment. I don't know that we want to see that. I don't even know if we have enough room in our jails. As it is right now, there's testimony that in South Carolina, 80 women were arrested. I can just tell you that I can feel the pain, and I don't envy it because I know that the people here mean well, and I am I'm going to do something that you're not going to like, but I'm going to do it because I'm sensing it, and I think it's the right thing to do. I'm going to hold the bill over until Friday, and I'm going to do so because I want to let people think, and I want to let you think, and I want to think. And then I want to bring it back up first thing on Friday. And I apologize if that offends you, but I'm just trying to make the best decision I can right now.
If I have a suggestion, it would be that you go back to the original language, and we'll try to get it drafted up for you, that eliminates completely the chance of a woman being prosecuted for what she does to herself. It has the additional problem that Senator or Representative Cott and Senator Green felt very strongly about, you know, and so on. But it is far better than nothing on the bill. And I think that that would probably eliminate at least a significant part of the consternation. But also, you know the old saying, the hard cases make for bad law. And I think that that's largely a stalking horse just for, and here I'm imputing motives, but a significant group of people that are worried that the, from my perspective, unintended consequence of this bill is that we would be recognizing in law that an unborn human child, Homo sapiens sapien, has intrinsic worth of its own. And that does produce some dichotomy in our thinking in this nation. And that, I think, is a part of the motivation for many of the objections that you have. And I think that they are largely, it's an imaginary problem that would be very rarely that anyone would be prosecuted. But that would be my suggestion when we come back
together. And I would like to hear more discussion from you personally on that, because I can honestly say, I know you don't like Roe v. Wade, but in terms of achieving a civil balance in this country, it's done so. And I don't want this committee to be used as a vehicle to go back to World War II. And I say that with every ounce of my being. And, you know, I think that's what Representative Garrow was trying to get at, too, that you have the substance of this bill, and you have us trying to put our arms around it, and then you have this other issue out there. And that is a very difficult thing to peel back. And one other thing I want to say to Representative Garrow about your amendment to just think about, that just troubles me a little to think about, is that when we look at tort law, there's the eggshell plaintiff theory. And we say that a victim is a victim. And if you intended the act against the victim, whatever harm results of that person, whatever harm becomes them, if they had a bad hip, if they had osteoporosis that you didn't know of, if you injure their liver and they go on to the hospital and give it a staph infection, whatever, you are responsible for the consequences, irrespective of what your intent was and irrespective of your awareness of it. And so the concern I have about this amendment is that we're saying that you knew or should have known. And, you know, I was one of those people in a first pregnancy. I was blessed that I didn't really even start showing until, you know, maybe 5 months. But my God, if somebody had harmed me, you know. Yeah.
That's a very good point, and I've been uncomfortable on how to do this, because there are different levels of crime. I think of what we're talking about, the worst is where you know somebody's pregnant and you attack her. That's the worst. You know it, and you did it anyway. Also bad is just what you talked about, which is you're a criminal, you attack a woman, and you shouldn't be given the benefit of the doubt that you accidentally caused a miscarriage. So I think maybe there needs to be something done that way. Probably the best way to do it is enhance all the penalties like we talk about, and then have an aggravator that says if you cause a miscarriage, regardless of whether you knew you were going to do it or regardless of whether you knew the woman was pregnant, that's also an aggravator. And I think Ms. Carpinetti convinced me that the judges on cases like this in felonies will take aggravators seriously. But I'd be happy to deal with an amendment to the amendment or a revision of the proposal to deal with that. You're absolutely right. You shouldn't get the benefit of the doubt that you just accidentally destroyed somebody's family.
So we'll bring it first up, I promise you.
All right, thank you.
Disappointment of everyone in the room and online.
I know none of you that lobby on this stuff even get paid for it, so it's not like I'm helping your careers. I mean, it's just, so with that, we're adjourned.